have a little comment, given that we are not from this country, and given we've seen Sickle. Canada realized quite a few years ago that we were in a maternity care crisis, and that's not what we're really going to talk about today, but there was a concerted effort from a real wide spectrum of the healthcare professionals, the CEOs of the hospitals, the provincial planners, to do something about it. And led, I have to say, by the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada, who are generally activists in our country. Just met a nurse this afternoon who said she just really wants nurses to be activists. I think there's quite a few activists in this room today. Where the discussions went. Well, one of the discussions led into the legislation of midwives and legislation of midwives to provide not just hospital care but community care. So I am a Canadian midwife, and I'm required by my government to offer both home birth to every woman. It's part of my obligation to my college, and I'm also obligated to offer a hospital birth to her if she wants it. So I'm required to have hospital privileges, and I'm paid by my government. So every woman in Ontario, where I practice, and in most of the provinces in Canada, have universal health care coverage for all pregnant women, and all pregnant women can decide where they want to have their baby. So how about that for a solution? Shall we start? Oh yeah, no. What's interesting is if they live in Ontario, we are obligated to serve them. If they're immigrants, we absolutely are obligated to serve them. And the government pays for it. We just don't do them if they're from Quebec. No, it's true. Quebec, you have to be living in Quebec to have your baby there, and you have to be living in Ontario to have your baby there. And I happen to work in the capital, in Ottawa, which is right on the border. So if we have a crisscross, they have to have an address in Ontario. And truth be told, sometimes women from Quebec come and have their baby at our house. So anyway, we... Oh, that's right. The number of midwives is really going up in Ontario and right across Canada because trying to meet this maternity care crisis. And we have tripled our midwifery education program, and there are almost as many midwives now as obstetricians. What's it like in the States? How many midwives to OBs? You ever thought of that? Well, I'm going to start off, I think, by also asking how many people in the room are already familiar with our British Medical Journal home birth study. Oh, not too many. Which means we probably should... We have presented before at APHA, and so we were not going to present a great deal about that, but it says to me that we probably should present, make sure we at least explain what it's about. All right, so let's... how do I change my little clicker here? Okay. This is the overview. I'd actually rather have, I want to see faces, if you can bear with me. So this is the overview of what we're going to do. We're going to talk about this large prospective home birth study, and just the take-home message for it, just so you know, is it found similar risk to the weight of home birth and low-risk hospital birth literature. Second that we're going to talk about is the APHA resolution, which passed in 2001 around home birth and with direct entry midwives. And we're going to talk a little bit about the media around home birth. We're also going to talk about the reaction from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which we find really interesting. And then we're going to talk about some other models that we think might be used to parallel with the midwifery situation. We love Marshall Klaus. We met Marshall Klaus many years ago, and we've always loved Marshall Klaus. For those of you who don't know, is the bonding guy. He's the one who first identified bonding as an important thing. And he said, theory divides and data unites. And that is how we have really come to, we've always felt that that would be the thing that would finally be able to help convince those who are skeptical about home birth that possibly it could be, even if not for them, at least an option for other people. So I just wanted to show you again, we're doing a few parallels here between Canada and the States. In the late 1990s, you can see what happened in Ontario. In 1994, this is what they said, because of midwifery being regulated, and that was the first year that it was regulated, because home birth is becoming more common, and because there's no compelling evidence from the literature one way or the other, they voted to rescind a 7-year policy that discouraged doctors from attending home births. So they made a decision that it was all right for physicians to do that. Now, I think that in the States, anyway, a lot of physicians have attended home births, but I know that I don't know whether actually their colleges or their societies condone it. Alberta had another take on it. They actually created protocols for physicians attending home births, and Alberta is the only province in Canada that has legislation for midwives that has not yet had their government actually fund them. And it did make me wonder if the physicians thought, well, that's something we would like to have jurisdiction over, and maybe we will do home births, and we will get, it's funded for us, right? And it's not funded for the midwives. So I don't know if that was the ploy, but obviously it was not the home birth. There's always some professional competition, but there's also the stigma of home versus hospital birth. So, prior to the study that we put out, there was already the substantial literature on intended home births. And it was all over the world. There's been lots of, home birth has been, in Holland still they do 35% home births. In London and in Britain, they're not doing quite as many. I keep talking this thing, excuse me. But it goes up and down. But certainly Holland has always maintained quite a number. Norway is looking at it again, actually, since our study, thankfully. And but the studies had varied in quality up to that point. But there were consistent findings of low perinatal mortality among low-risk women giving birth at home. And perinatal mortality, for those of you who don't know, it's death of the baby at any time after about 28 weeks, up to about 6 weeks. So what we made a decision to do, and this was after we had created a database for various groups, the Canadian Midwife Statistics Collaboration, the Midwives Alliance of North America, and a number of people who were in neither of those groups. But and we wanted to do it really because we wanted to show the nuances of care of midwives. But we kept having legislators come to us and midwives from various states coming to say, what we really need is we just need a really good national study on home birth. And this is why we did this, because we also wanted something that was systematic. We wanted to do it prospectively because the critique of some of the other home birth studies was that they were done retrospectively and therefore the midwives must be pushing under the rug all the bad outcomes because they didn't tell you ahead of time what births they were going to be doing. Epidemiologically, we just had to have a study that was defined over a certain time period, so we chose the year 2000. The millennium sounded like a good time to do it. And we also had to define target population. So there were the clients of midwives who had this new national intercontinental certified professional midwife credential. And we went to the North American Registry of Midwives to ask for their full cooperation, and they agreed to make it mandatory for the midwives to actually join in our study in order to be recertified. And that was a huge thing for them to do, a very, very difficult thing for them to do. We have tried to do that for many years. We tried to do it in Canada. It was very difficult. The only way we've been able to do it in Canada is to tie it to funding. It's easier to do it there because you don't get paid if you don't turn in your data. But here you can't do that. So this was a big step for them. And we also did direct validation procedures. What we did was we phoned over 10% of the mothers just to validate that what the midwife had said had happened actually happened. Again, another just to check, because when you're having a home birth, who else, who can tell you what really happened? And we also needed this large study right nationally, because there had already been a number of studies done just within jurisdictions, particular states, and we had done some of those studies, actually. So at the same time, what we realized is we actually started attending APHA at that point. And one of the things we realized was that APHA was a wonderful foundation for us for a couple of things. One is some of the midwives that were on the NARM board were attending APHA, and it was the APHA Maternal Child Health Division that made them realize how important data was to prove themselves. And at the same time, we decided that if we were going to take this on, we were going to be very transparent about it. We were going to run by our methodology, by the epidemiologists here, and we were going to promise that we were going to publish it, no matter what the data said. And this was a huge step, a very, very difficult step for the midwives to take, because they didn't really know. They assumed that what they were doing was all right, but until you collect data, you could have a very high perinatal mortality rate that you're not aware of. And it was you can imagine, it was a very scary thing for the midwives to do. But they did it. And this is just some of the APHA decided to put forth this resolution on increasing access to out-of-hospital maternity care services once they saw that we were doing the study. Once they were recognizing that the evidence was coming in, that it looked like home birth was, in fact, a safe, viable option, and once we finally did show them the preliminary data, they finally passed this resolution, which said, APHA supports efforts to increase access to out-of-hospital maternity care services through recognition that legally regulated and nationally certified direct entry midwives can serve clients desiring safe, planned out-of-hospital maternity services. So this was the publication, and I just want to show you this slide because the way to get to it is you can go to, we found the easiest way is to go to BMJ Davis, D-A-V-I-S-S, because very few people have a name with two S's, and Ken Johnson, my co-author here, he's much more published than I am, and so his name pops up a lot on BMJ. All right, so just I'm going to show you one slide, and I'm going to let Ken take over. I just wanted to show you one of the first things we noticed, and it was fascinating. We compared our study to two studies. We compared it to the NIH data, the National Institutes of Health, and it just so happened that the Listening to Mothers survey done by the Maternity Care Association, which is now Childbirth Connection, came out around the same time. And look at the yellow bars. The yellow bars is the amount of intervention of each of these things. The first, do we have a little... electrophil monitor, IVs, right? See the epidurals. Look at the different rates of the. See, this is the U.S. data for all of the U.S. Right, 84% of American women get electrophil monitoring. 85% get an IV. 67% have their membranes ruptured. 63% at that time, this is year 2000, get an epidural, and perhaps more now. 33% were still getting episiotomies. This is after episiotomies have already been shown by randomized control trials not to be a very smart option. And look at the differences. But this is the big one right here. Look at this. The C-section rate for the certified professional midwives planning home births. Now, this is women who are planning at the beginning of the labor to have a baby at home. They can be transferred to hospital if they need a cesarean. But the amount they actually had a cesarean was 3.7%, and at that time in hospitals, it was 19% among low-risk women. This is not high-risk women. This is low-risk women defined by singleton, vertex, and term babies. And this was these were the results for antenatal deaths, three fatal birth defects, 5 intrapartum deaths, 6 neonatal deaths. And so it came to this perinatal mortality, not perinatal, excuse me, intrapartum and neonatal mortality, 2 per 1,000 intended home births. And when we took out the breeches in twins, which are considered high risk actually in other data, it came to 1.7 in 1,000. And that is very respectable, which Ken will talk to you about. So these are the basic conclusions. Planned home birth for low-risk women in North America using certified professional midwives was associated with lower rates of medical intervention, but similar intrapartum and neonatal mortality to that of low-risk hospital births in the United States. We said similar, we couldn't say the same because we couldn't get a direct comparison. And this was the reaction.
Well, the reaction, at least among midwives and pregnant women, I guess. So the British Medical Journal is a very interesting place to publish. If you've gone there, one of the great beauties of it is you can write letters to the editor that will be placed on the web within 24 hours if they consider the letter to have some value. And you send in your letter right off the website, and you get this immediate email, very polite email, thank you very much for submitting this to the BMJ. We'll consider it very carefully, and if you do consider it to be of value to our readership, we will post it on the web tomorrow. And so there ended up being 27 letters between under the editorial and under the actual article, so you can go and read all the correspondence, and it comes from everywhere from India to Northern Ontario, and of course a huge diversity of opinion on it. We were of course expecting commentary from obstetricians because they traditionally do not have much use for home birth, but surprisingly we saw almost no response from them at all. And so we had Marsden Wagner sort of waiting in the wings as our guy to respond to what the obstetricians had to say. Well, finally, about a month later, we were talking to Marsden. Well, Marsden, I guess you might as well write your letter now. It looks like they're not going to respond. So he wrote, when a study is published, and Marsden Wagner was the head of maternal child health at the World Health Organization for almost 20 years in Copenhagen for the European region, but an American perinatologist, pediatrician. He said, and he's written on this kind of thing before in places like the BMJ and the Lancet, when a study is published with scientifically valid evidence against an important position of a clinical group, clinicians have two common reactions: ignore the study and hope it goes away, or torture the data until it confesses to what they want it to say. And he concluded in this article that apparently they had decided to pretend it had this study of 5,500 home births across North America, and a systematic prospective study had not happened. Furthermore, he said, of the midwives and the mother, this group the midwives and the moms having these home births were the demedicalization group, and this group recognized the excellence of methodology, the importance of the findings, and the consistency with the existing weight of evidence, was part of what he said in his letter. The second largest group of responders in terms of letters to the BMJ is primary care physicians, some of whom are generally positive about the findings, while others try to torch the data to justify running from the heresy of agreeing to health care which is not in some kind of medical setting. This information does not change my practice. However, a couple of them said at the end of their letters, in spite of acknowledging that the evidence seemed to be pretty good. So there was only one American obstetrician who responded in the BMJ, and he said he was positive about the data, but had a fear of litigation. We won't go through the individual studies, but these are just this. We looked for all studies in North America that have been done on low-risk in low-risk hospital groups and low-risk home birth groups, and this just lists the the home birth studies over the last 20 years, with the neonatal and/or intrapartum mortality rates on the right, and you can see they range from about 0.6 to about 3.5. Here's some more of the more recent ones, including ours at the bottom there. Then these were, these are actually the hospital birth studies. No, sorry, this is a continuation of the home birth studies. Then we move in some more home birth studies. And these are international studies of home birth with very similar findings and outcomes. and then we move into the hospital birth studies. And one thing to note with these is that they tend to not include interpartum, but just neonatal deaths. So not deaths during labor, just deaths after labor. One thing we couldn't do in our study was we could not create a group that was collected prospectively for low-risk hospital births the same as our home birth group, because there's just no mechanism to do it. We might have been able to do something like that in Canada if we had a lot of money, which we didn't. So we just did these informal comparisons to the other existing literature, because you'd have to sign up prospectively 5,000 or 10,000 hospital births across the country in a random kind of way, and then follow all those through and get all the buy-in. It would cost millions and millions of dollars if you could possibly even do it. So we did, though, have one, there was one study that was very interesting for us, and that was a study done as a PhD thesis at Stanford. And this fellow, Peter Schlenska, who did the study, had found that there was data in California that had been collected for a cesarean study where they had linked the birth certificates to the hospital separation certificates, so they had much more complete picture of what happened at each birth. And they'd done this for 2 years in California, so they had 865,000 births, I think, that they were looking at. You'd think that you made all these slides. Not some of them were made, but many of them were made by me, but that's all right. When Peter Schlenska compared the 3,500, or more than 3,500, or almost 3,500 planned home births with the 800,000 low-risk hospital births, he consistently found a non-significantly lower perinatal mortality in the home birth group. And we talk about that in our BMJ and reference his article, or his thesis, published thesis. So when we went to look at the birth certificate data, the NIH does publish yearly statistics on birth certificates, but birth certificates are notorious for having low quality information associated with risk factors and outcomes, birth defects, etc. So we didn't do a direct comparison. But in 2004, they started to do it a little better. Some of the birth certificates changed, and they started to report on gestation among selected groups. We've had a commentary by someone, obstetrician, on our data saying, oh, the death rate among term births in the United States of non-Hispanic white women is much lower than what you found in your study, because we found 1.7 or 2, depending on whether you include the breeches and twins or not. And she pointed out that, oh, it's only 0.76 deaths per 1,000, and you're seeing more than double that risk. Well, I want to just give you a very quick analysis of that in case you've seen that, because that's gotten some traction. First of all, that was the date. She's referencing 2004 because that's the first time they reported non-Hispanic white births by gestation. So to have term, they had reported earlier, they'd been reporting by birth weight, which isn't quite the same. But the birth weight of 2,500 grams or more, then the number of deaths was about 0.9 per 1,000 in the year 2000. It had dropped to about 0.75 by the year 2004. So her number of 0.76 would actually be more for 2004 would be more like 0.9 for the year 2000. So really the reference we're comparing should be something more like 0.9 deaths per 1,000. When we look at our deaths, first of all, we have a total deaths of 14 deaths, 5 interpartum and 9 neonatal deaths. Well, first of all, the stats in the birth certificate, the NIH data, does not include interpartum deaths, only deaths of babies who are born alive.
And actually, this one, but there's a number of OBs we find that really like to compare our data to their data, and they almost invariably only compare to the neonatal data. It's incredible we find how skewed people have tried to make this database, like how much they have tried to make it look like it doesn't say what it says.
So anyway, we have 5 interpartum deaths that we take off, so we're down to 9 deaths. Then we have 3 birth defect deaths that we've decided to remove, and the reason we've removed them, although they're if they would be in the NIH data, is that in each of those situations, it's a different situation than you have among non-Hispanic white women in general, would not follow this kind of care. One of the women, we have, I think, 13% of our women are Mennonite, or Amish, many of them from Pennsylvania. It's about 600 or 700 births in our database of 5,500 planned home births. And one of those babies was a dwarf that died. And that would be the kind of thing that would be picked up in hospital through ultrasound, which women would normally have. Betty Ann, you can talk about the other two.
Actually, the woman actually did have an ultrasound, but she chose to have the baby at home anyway, and she chose to carry to term. And another one was...
Knowing that it would die.
Yeah, and there was another one, was a trisomy 13, which is definitely a lethal anomaly. And the average person in the States, we think, would have had an abortion, even if, or some kind of a termination, just because it is an anomaly. The woman was age 42, and what happens is you go through huge, incredible perspective, trying to figure out what to do about this, because you know the baby's going to die, and even if you don't agree with abortion, if you're 42, when you know you may not be able to get pregnant again, and the time is ticking away, it's usually condoned in most areas to have an abortion. And again, this woman didn't actually know that. That woman's and the third one was a very special. I always forget how to say it. Acrisola. It's a special syndrome that has major heart defects, things that would all be cleft palate, major things that would be picked up on ultrasound again. And again, this woman chose not to have an ultrasound. It was a chiropractic family, and they just chose not to have any ultrasounds at all.
Finally, the comparison, of course, was to non-Hispanic white women, and we don't have many Native Americans or other ethnic origins in our study. Most of them are white and non-Hispanic, but there were 286 Hispanics and African Americans and others, and among those there was one death. So we removed that death from the numerator and the births from the denominator, and we end up with five deaths and just over 5,000 births, which is a little less than 1 per 1,000, 0.97 neonatal deaths, 0.97 neonatal deaths per 1,000 births, which is very similar to the 0.9 that would have been reported in the NIH. One thing we did notice, though, when we were looking at this NIH data that I think is very important here, is we discovered that 11.3% of non-Hispanic white women had a premature birth in this data set. So those are all not included in this very low perinatal mortality, but 11.3% is very high. Among our midwife births, when we went back to look at the number that died prematurely in our midwife sample, it was more around 4 or 5%. And prematurity, of course, is a very good marker for higher perinatal mortality. So there's other unanswered questions we'll talk about now. In terms of the actual article, it's been quite remarkable. Because it's on the web and freely accessible, we were just stunned. It turned out to be the third most popular article in the British Medical Journal, which publishes 52 times a year for the year 2005. And it's now been, and they continue to count how often it's accessed, it's now been accessed almost 85,000 times, and it's accessed at the rate of 1,000 to 1,500 different individuals go every month to the site, to that article, which is, we've just been thrilled. I mean, we're trying to get the word out, and you can't imagine, the internet's an amazing thing. Betty Ann will take over now.
So, as a result of the popularity of this article, which is gaining ground, shortly after that, within about a year of the article coming out, Wisconsin made a decision to go to legislation, and they used the BMJ study. And one of the things that was wonderful for us to hear is that when they started off their hearing, the legislators said, we just want you to know, there's not going to be a debate about home birth here. This is just a debate about CPMs and how they're going to be registered, because they had already made a decision that the case was closed. They'd seen the article, they were convinced. And it was so wonderful for us to see that they really were using data. Shortly after that, Missouri also was looking towards it. The Missouri legislators were not quite so interested in the data. They were interested in the data, but not so interested in using the data for their legislation purposes, just doing it so categorically. Indiana also, I went to testify for Indiana. There was one obstetrician who came to talk about the comparison and said that it wasn't a randomized control trial, so I had to go through into great detail why you can't do a randomized control trial with home birth, because you can't force any woman to have a hospital birth if she doesn't want to, and it would be unethical to have those two, just randomly assign people to home or hospital birth. So here we go. then ACOG came out of the blue, and they came out with a statement. They said, studies comparing this is after the pressure from Wisconsin, Missouri, Indiana, there were more and more states starting to go for legislation, and this is ACOG's reaction. Studies comparing the safety and outcome of U.S. births in the hospital with those occurring in other settings are limited and have not been scientifically rigorous. This is after we've spent long making sure we had the pristine article that would get published in one of the most prestigious British medical journals in the world. The development of well-designed research studies of sufficient size, ours was very much a sufficient size, excuse me while I digress each phrase, prepared in consultation with obstetric departments. We had an advisory council and we had an obstetrician from Canada. Maybe that's not considered a real obstetric department, but and he was one actually who made sure we went for autopsy reports to make sure that whatever we did was totally scrutinized. And approved by institutional review boards, we had an ethics committee, might clarify the comparative safety of births in different... Might clarify the comparative safety of births in different settings. Until the results of such studies are convincing, ACOG strongly opposes out-of-hospital births. Although ACOG acknowledges a woman's right to make informed decisions regarding her delivery, ACOG does not support programs or individuals that advocate for or who provide out-of-hospital births. And then later, they had a meeting with CNMs, and the CNMs really pushed them on not including all out-of-hospital births. So they took out the out-of-hospital births and just decided they would just, just oppose home births. So, in the midst of obstetricians in the States apparently having their heads in the sand, we wanted to just show you that in other jurisdictions that's not true. We talked to you a little bit about the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Ontario, but what we found is that this is a new statement. Originally, the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada in 1997, this is 3 years after our legislation came through, said, I'll just read you the first line, SOGC is opposed to home births because of potential risks to mother and fetus. Women should be informed adequately about the risk of birth at home or in freestanding birth centers, and especially about potential difficulty in emergency transport in a country with such diverse geography, population density, and weather as Canada. But by 2003, with some research behind them, they said, they changed it to, the SOGC recognizes and stresses the importance of choice for women and their families in the birthing process. The SOGC recognizes that women will continue to choose the setting in which they will give birth. Thank God. All women should receive information about the risks and benefits of their chosen place for giving birth and should understand any identified limitation of care at their planned birth setting. And they did admit that hospital birth carries its own risks. So this is André Lalonde, who's the vice executive president of the SOGC with midwives. He's a very good friend of midwives. And then the Royal College of Obstetricians and Royal College of Midwives of Britain also put out a statement. This is this year, 2007, based on the increase in research. And so what we've come to conclude is that reality is defined by cultural paradigm. And the cultural paradigm in the United States of America needs to change. And this might be the only thing that will change them. And this is what we're looking at now. This is the chiropractor example we're talking about. Five doctors of chiropractic filed an antitrust lawsuit in 1976. It was because the AMA had created a written goal to contain and eliminate a competitor, the chiropractic profession. They made it unethical for any MD to associate with a DC in any way, shape, or form. I won't go through the rest of the slide, but this is the result. Oh, the result is not coming up. First of all, ACOG put out a statement not just against home birth, but also against lay midwifery. And they, although they didn't mention CPMs by name, they said that they could, they would only recognize those that were certified through the American College of Nursing and Midwives. So this is another thing. This is what we're finding right now. We've been asked to go to a lot of legislatures to testify and also to testify on behalf of midwives who are being sought out by a number of, it sounds like there seems to be a committee of ACOG that is seeking out mid-level providers. We've actually got a committee doing that. It was. I want to talk to them. So this is the last slide. Second to last, there's a picture. On August 27, 1987, the judge issued a 101-page opinion finding the AMA guilty of long-term wrongdoing in illegally attempting to eliminate the chiropractor profession. In September of 1987, the judge issued a permanent injunction against the AMA and all of its members from ever trying to destroy the profession through such an illegal boycott again. I think there are parallels here. So how can we help the medical world understand that home birth like global warming is not going to go away? Who knows? I mean, you know, until Al Gore came along, like, it just, people just did not seem to admit that the glaciers were melting. And what we're trying to figure out is, and what we're doing with our database, is trying to help OBs, midwives, and the public understand why the picture on the left just seems to be better for some women than the picture on the right. We just want to give you our database here. This is that's our website.